My wife Jackie is here with me. She told me not to wear this red shirt tonight. She said it accented my already red face. I want you to know it's not sunburn. We got out on the beach this afternoon and I've been sandblasted. Can't imagine anybody coming from Florida and going to the beach in North Carolina. We tried it this afternoon, and hopefully it'll be better tomorrow. I recommend it to you, though. It's going to be very nice out there. I'm delighted to be here. This is a real honor. I was sitting here tonight thinking how long it's been since I've been at a CFO meeting, and I guess the last time was, I was with Tommy Tyson and Estelle Carver out at Ardmore, Oklahoma, and that's been, gosh, I don't know, a long time ago. And so it's good to be back in on CFO ground, and especially to be here with. I stood tonight between Al Durrance and Jim Brown, and I have known these men for 15, 17 years, and our paths have crossed, but always just behind each other. This is the first time, and Al was down there in Florida for so long, and Jim Brown kind of set the whole thing in motion, and people were quoting him and imitating him, going through mimics, you know. This is the way Jim Brown does it. And so I'm just honored to be here with these fellows that I have admired and respected for so long. And Horace Hilton's been after me to get here for I don't know how long. Horace even made a special trip down to Florida and said, please show up at Wilmington, and we've just waited on the Lord, and so we feel this is God's time. I really don't know who to blame for this. Liz Messick began badgering me years ago, and then Bill Garthwaite began telling me what a great place this was and how marvelous things happened at the CFO, and I was able to put them off. The only guy I couldn't put off was Dan White. Dan just has that way about him. And when he came in the dining room tonight and said, everybody get up and leave, well, I got up and left because I do whatever Dan says. And Dan said that I should that I should come down here to this. And it just kind of all fell in place. And then I knew that it was the Lord when it looked like everything was falling apart. And I had agreed to come 2 years ago. And a whole bunch of things have changed in my life over these last 2 years. They changed over the last couple of weeks. And I tried to get out of it, and nobody would hear to that. And so, anyway, we're delighted to be here. We feel it's God's timing for this. I think the Lord is going to do something special with each one of you. I don't believe that you're here by accident. I don't think you're here because your wife or husband coerced you, or even because somebody found a ride for you and paid your way. I don't think that's the real reason that you're here. I think you're here because God wants you here. I think you're here because He has a plan for your life, a purpose for your life, which has not yet been fulfilled. And that's for every one of you. There's not a single one of you here in this room who has fulfilled all that God has for you. Some of you have started in that direction, but not a single one of us have reached that kind of perfect fulfillment, and I think this is going to be a big step forward for every one of us who are here at this conference at this time. So, Father, I ask you in the name of Jesus Christ to touch us in a special way tonight. I pray, Lord, that even while I'm speaking, that your Holy Spirit will take control of the minds and the hearts and the spirits of these who are sitting here in this room and carry us wherever you want us to go, that it'll not necessarily be my words that are heard tonight. And Lord, if you want some of your folks to sit here and daydream, then I pray that you anoint and sanctify those daydreams and that you speak through them in a creative way. We've got problems, Lord, and a lot of us have not been able to leave them behind. We've brought them with us. And I believe that you want to minister to those problem areas of our life. And so I trust you to do that, to take total and complete control of what's happening here for these next few minutes. In the name of your Son, Jesus, I pray. Amen. All my life, I've been searching for God. I didn't know that. For years, I didn't know that. But now, in looking back on it, I realize that all of my searches have been for God. I thought at one time it was for security. I thought it was for money. I thought it was for prestige. But as I look back on all of the search times of my life and see them from this side of 50 years of age, I realize that all of my searching has been for God. I remember 35 years ago as a 17-year-old boy, senior in high school, lying on my bed reading Glenn Clark. My parents were searching for God. They found him, or rather, the correct terminology, he met them the following year, my freshman year in college. But my dad had found some books by Glenn Clark, and I read one, and I was impressed that Glenn Clark had been a football coach, and that was my life. Everything was wrapped up in athletics at the time. And I began to dig in, and I bought everything that McAllister Press ever had to offer by Glenn Clark. And then I read Star Daily, and then I read Rufus Mosley. And I didn't know anything about Camp Farthest Out. I mean, he really wasn't pushing Camp Farthest Out in these books. But I would relate back. My spiritual roots go back to those early times of reading and wondering, what is it that this man has that I'm eager to have? There's something that he's touched that I know is real. I wasn't finding it in my church, unfortunately. I wasn't finding it in my own home, in my own family. I wasn't finding it in my own Sunday school class that I went to. I was a Baptist and went to something called BYPU. Some of you remember that. Later that was changed to BTU, and then finally it was shortened to TU. Baptist Young People's Union, then Baptist Training Union, then just Training Union. Finally dropped the thing altogether, I think. But anyway, I was involved in all of that kind of activity as a kid, and I wasn't finding God. And then I ran across these books by Glenn Clark, and I've been on a search. Still am, for that matter. You know, it's interesting. I've always wanted to write something that would be acceptable in CFO circles. So much of the stuff I've written I didn't think would be acceptable in CFO circles. And I've always wanted to write. And I was sitting here tonight, Horace, while you were talking about silence, and realized that this last book I've done called A Way Through the Wilderness, and I've got a whole chapter in there on silence, another chapter on solitude that I have finally tapped in. I didn't even think about that until just a minute ago. Tapped into some of those roots that I put down years and years and years ago of a desire to find God in silence, of a desire to find him in solitude, of a desire to be alone without being lonely. And I've touched that in A Way Through the Wilderness. Well, I want to talk to you tonight about something close to me. In that wonderful warm movie called E.T. You remember that strange, ugly little creature from outer space that showed up in somebody's imagination and finally made it to the silver screen, and he had a vocabulary of four words. And those four words were Elliot. That was the name of his friend who discovered him and gave him, was going to give him M&Ms and wound up giving him Reese's Cups, I think, yeah. Elliot. And be good, which he said is one word. And ouch. And home. Those were the four words. And I thought about that. I thought about how interesting that a Hollywood movie maker could could actually grab hold of all humankind and put them into four words. Those four words consist of all of the basic drives that make up humankind. Your friend, in this case a little kid by the name of Elliot. Be good, which deals with our ethics and our behavior, all of that aspect of life. Ouch, which deals with our pain, our hurt. And then that marvelous word, home. I've lived in six places over my 52 years. I was born and grew up, as did my wife, Jackie, in a little town on the east coast of Florida, Vero Beach. And for the first 20 years of our lives, 19 years of our lives, Vero Beach was home. Jackie and I started dating when we were both in high school. She was a sophomore and I was a junior. She wanted to get married on the second date, and I put her off for 6 years. Primarily because my very wise father said, the moment you get married, you support her. And I will not. And I decided it was going to be best to wait until after I finished a college education and was at least started on that process. But Vero Beach, Florida was home for me, for all of this. Then I spent 4 years in Macon, Georgia, where I went to college at Mercer University. And then Jackie and I married, and we spent another 4 years in Fort Worth, Texas, where I was going to graduate school, to the Baptist Seminary out there, preparing for God knew what I didn't. And then we spent almost 9 years following that in Greenwood, South Carolina, where I became the pastor of a Southern Baptist church in Greenwood. Out of place all the time, Horace, I tell you. It was... I'll not tell you tonight why we left, but it was a pretty nasty situation. And we were about 2.5 steps in front of what Will Orr calls the TNF committee, the Tar and Feathers Committee, when we got out of Greenwood, South Carolina, and fled back to Florida, literally fled back to Florida, where we moved to where we are now. Melbourne, Florida, which is 30 miles north of my original home. I've made full circle with that kind of thing. I've thought about those places we've lived. None of those places were home. We lived there. And in some of those places, like in Fort Worth, where we owned our first house at $44 a month house payments, Greenwood, South Carolina, where we were there for 8 years, 9 years, lived in a beautiful Baptist parsonage, which was not ours the moment I was fired from the church. And those places were good places to live, and we had a delightful time, made many friends, but they weren't home. And the reason I know they weren't home is because when we were there, we were always talking about going home. We're like E.T. We were always wanting to phone home. We would go home for Christmas, home for vacation. None of those places were home. Now for 19, almost 20 years, we've been back in Melbourne. And gradually over this period of time, some things have changed. While we've been there, my dad died. My wife's dad has died over that period of time. The old home place has changed hands. The house that I grew up in as a child has been passed on to somebody else. And even though we make occasional trips back to Vero Beach, I no longer refer to Vero Beach, Florida as home. You ask me where home is now, and I say home is Melbourne, Florida. And the reason I know it's home is because that's where my family lives. That's where my children are. At least that's where they call home. Some of them have grown up and married. But we've got children there, and we've got some grandchildren there, and all of our other kids are talking about coming home. They live at different places. We have a son in Washington, D.C., and we have a daughter and son-in-law and a little grandbaby out in Tulsa. And we've got a son and daughter-in-law and two grandchildren in Tifton, Georgia. And they're always talking about coming home. And by coming home, they mean coming back to where Mom and Dad are. And that's home. The other reason I know it's home is because the people who have come around us have become part of our family. We have entered into relationship. And I have made some commitments. Home is where you make commitments, permanent commitments. And I have made permanent commitments to the people there that I'm going to live there the rest of my life. Now, unless God really writes something in the sky, sticks it under the door. We had heard a word from God that said, go to Melbourne, Florida, and stay there. Now, we don't stay there very much. We do a lot of other things. But that's home. I'm always eager to get back there. I'm going to go back home Sunday so that I can be with my people on Sunday. That's very important to me to do that. That's some commitments that I've made. I'm going to be back up here on Monday. But I had to work all that kind of thing out because these are priorities in my life. These are very deep commitments in my life. We're native Floridians. For a long time, the church that I'm in, which is an interdenominational church in Melbourne, for a long time, we were the only native Floridians there. Now, you North Carolinians don't have to worry about that kind of thing because you never left home to start with. But we don't have very many natives down there. In fact, the natives wear a little license tags that say natives. And then you see others that say almost natives. And others that says, who cares? You know, but we're natives. And we've had a tough time, the little town that we're living in. When we knew it as a child, town only had 2,000 population. Now it's grown up to far more than 100,000. And everybody's come in. Most of our folks are engineer types, and they work at the Space Center there at Cape Kennedy, which we're at the southern end of Cape Kennedy. But we've had a tough time trying to get people to put their roots down. This is a transit society that we live in. And we can't get folks to get rooted. And the way that I know they're not rooted is because they're always talking about going home. They're going to go home for the summer. They're going to go home for their vacation. They're going to go home for Christmas. They called home last week. And I know that you're really not home until your vocabulary begins to change in those areas. We've got folks 70, 80 years old who've lived in Florida for 30 years, and they're still talking about way back home in Indiana, back home. And one of the reasons I know that that's home for them is because that's where they've bought their burial plot. I'm not going to be buried down here in Florida. My goodness, the water's only 2 feet under the ground. I'll float to the surface. I'm going to go back to Kentucky, Iowa. I'm going to North Dakota, wherever they came from. They're going home to be buried. They've already made instructions, and they've got people to witness, put it on paper, cut their wrists, sign it in blood, all that kind of thing. Don't bury me in Florida. I want to go home when I'm buried. Now, in the biblical sense of the word, home was where you were going to be buried. That's where home was, in the biblical sense. Remember that wonderful little passage out of the book of Ruth, where Naomi has gone off into Moab, which is now today the nation of Jordan. And she's left her family back in Bethlehem. And she's gone off into Moab with her husband and her sons, and her husband and her sons have died. And her two daughters-in-law, one of them saying, I'm going to stay here in Moab. And Naomi says, I'm going to go home. I want to go back to Bethlehem. No need for me to stay here. All of my family's gone. And Ruth speaks up with that marvelous passage that many have incorporated into the wedding ceremony. And let me read it to you out of the New International Version. Don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. And where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. Home. Bethlehem was going to be Ruth's home. And the way we know it is because she said, I'm going to have me a burial plot there. Israel was to be her home. In the heart of Ruth, Israel was her home. Now let me show you another interesting little Bible passage while we're at it tonight. There's an interesting little progression that takes place in the life of Joseph. And if you have a Bible, let me just run you through something. In Genesis 50, Genesis 50, which is the last chapter of the book of Genesis, Genesis 50, verse 24. Genesis 50, 24. Joseph. Remember who Joseph was? Joseph was the son of Israel. Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel. And Joseph had gone down into Egypt, and then all of his brothers and his family and his father, old Jacob, had followed him down there, and old Jacob had died, and now Joseph has grown old. And the book of Genesis closes with the death of Joseph. Then Joseph said to his brothers, this is Genesis 50, 24, I'm about to die, but God will surely come to your aid and take you up out of this land to the land he promised on an oath to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And Joseph made the sons of Israel swear an oath and said, God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones from this place. You must carry my bones from this place. All right? So Joseph died at the age of 110, and after they embalmed him, he was placed in a coffin in Egypt. That's the way the book of Genesis closes out. Now look at Exodus 13, 19. Exodus 13, 19. This is, maybe 460 years, maybe 430 years later. 430 years later. America has been a nation for 206 years or 8 years, something like this. This is 430 years later. Exodus 13:19. Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, because Joseph had made the sons of Israel swear an oath. And he said, God will surely come to your aid, and then you must carry my bones up with you from this place. That's a direct quote from the last chapter of the book of Genesis. Now, one more verse of scripture. Joshua 24:32. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. What's next? Joshua. Okay, there it is. Joshua 24:32. Last chapter, last few verses of Joshua. And Joseph's bones, which the Israelites had brought up from Egypt, were buried at Shechem, in the tract of land that Jacob, his father, had bought for 100 pieces of silver from the sons of Hamor, the father of Shechem, and this became the inheritance of Joseph's descendants. 500 years later, Joseph is home. He's not home until he's back in Israel. Home to him was Israel. Home was very important to those early Jews. It's very important to me. Home's extremely important. When I left home this morning, I prayed the angels would protect that place. We've got all kinds of things going on around there. My son-in-law and my daughter are getting ready to build a house right in front of our house. And they're digging dirt out of our backyard. I've got a cow that's due to have a calf any minute. In fact, we left home before dawn this morning. Jackie was out in the pasture checking Gertie to see whether we had a little Gertie had appeared during the night. And we had a lot of things going on, very important things. Home is a very important place to me. Constantly calling home to check on things. Home was important to those early Jews. Home is important to us today. Today's Jews have a name for those who return to Israel. It's called Aliyah. And Aliyah essentially means coming home. If you make Aliyah to Israel, you are coming home. I still remember my first trip into the Sinai back in 1975. I've been a number of times since then, usually going for 2 weeks at a time and camping, mountain climbing, doing research on this book I was talking about on the wilderness. But I remember that first trip I made to the Sinai at a place called Ein Hudra, of squatting in the sand, barefooted, in the desert, digging through the sand and those pebbles with my fingers and letting it run through my hands, and suddenly having one of those feelings, those unexplainable kind of feelings that said, you're home. This is where everything in you goes back. It goes back to that place where God first spoke to man in the Sinai, where the thunderings and the rumblings of Mount Sinai and the law was given, and God spoke to the corporate people. First time that the corporate people had ever heard the voice of God was in that place. And I remember being there with that sand all around me running through my fingers and there in my shorts and suddenly realizing, home. I'm not a Jew, but I have made Aliyah. The psalmist wrote about it in Psalm 137 when he talked about those Jewish people who were carried off into exile. And said, by the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept when we remembered home, when we remembered Zion. There on the poplars we hung our harps, for how can we sing the songs of Zion in a foreign land? Your heart is only full of song when you're home. When you're home. Now I began this evening by making a little confession to you, of saying that I've realized just recently that all of my life I've been searching for God. All of my life, every search in me has been a search for God. And I can understand what the psalmist said, how lovely is thy dwelling place, O Lord Almighty, for my soul is homesick for the courts of the Lord. That's what's been chewing in me all these years. I've been homesick. I've been homesick for the courts of the Lord. My father's been gone for how long, honey? 5 years now, I guess. Every once in a while, I'll get quiet in one of those meditative times. And I'll get homesick for my daddy. There's a real need inside of every boy to please his daddy. In fact, I've got some psychologist friends who tell me that everything man does is designed to please his daddy. Everything a man does is still a little kid coming home with a paper that he's drawn in kindergarten or the first grade and with a crayon, walking up to his daddy, handing it to him, and then standing back and waiting for some kind of reaction, some kind of approval. Oh, that's great, son. Gee, that looks just like an elephant, I think. That's really good. You've really done a good job with that. I do a lot of things with my sons. We're a touching family. And I learned a long time ago how necessary it was for me to touch my kids. Put my arm around my sons. I was 45 years old before I ever kissed my daddy. And he was 85 years old. We shook hands, us Buckinghams. That was important. My dad would say, look him straight in the eye. Don't look down at your feet. Look him straight in the eye, squeeze his hand and give it just a little shake, and that way you're in charge. We shook hands. My dad taught us how to shake hands. Come home to see my dad, shake hands. And then God began to get hold of me. He said, you can hug everybody else in the world. You can't hug your own daddy. He was in a wheelchair. I went down to Vero Beach just a short time before he died. Told him, I've come for one purpose. He said, okay, what is it? I remember he was sitting in his study working on his big green ledger book. He had been a businessman all of his life. Working on a big green ledger book. And I said, I've just come for one purpose. And he said, what's that? I said, I've come to tell you that I love you. And I want to kiss you. I reached down and kissed him on his bald forehead, kind of like I've got. Something broke loose inside of me. I've made sure that my sons don't have to go through that kind of thing. We kiss each other. We're very affectionate. Our three daughters, we do a lot of hugging and embracing. A lot of hands-on activity. Because there's something inside of every one of us that wants to be hugged by a father. Wants to have a daddy's arms around us. And it's not just earthly father. We have found, I've got an adopted sister. My younger sister, Audrey, doesn't know who her real father is. That's really immaterial to her. Because she found a father, or a father found her. And she grew up in a family of handshakers, but later on my dad found it easier to hug the girls than he did the boys. But she wasn't just looking for a daddy's love. She was just looking for love. That was all. Well, if that's the case, then when your daddy dies, you're going to be a miserable kind of person. Not so. Because what we're really yearning for is what David was talking about. Our hearts are homesick for the courts of the Lord. What I really want is the Father's arms around me. I want to be in the presence of God. And so all of my life, I've been searching for God. There's a fascinating story in Genesis, the 26th chapter, and let me just kind of outline it here for you. It's a progression story. It has to do with Isaac. Isaac was Jacob's father, and Isaac lived in the land of the Philistines
enemy territory. This was not home for him. He lived in the land. In fact, Isaac didn't have a home. He was a nomad. He was a wanderer. And Isaac moved down into the land of Gath, which is now the Gaza Strip, the land of the Philistines. And he became prosperous down there, extremely prosperous, because he was a good businessman. And he became prosperous, and the Philistines became jealous. And they went around stopping up all of his wells. They were trying to get rid of him. In that particular land, as it is today, water is the most important ingredient for everything. If you don't have water, and if you're in the business of raising flocks, herds, you're in trouble. And so the Philistines went around, and they stopped up all the wells that his father Abraham had dug. And now it became necessary for Isaac to dig new wells. Because in Israeli culture, a new well is a sign of being at home. And so now it became necessary for him to dig a new well. Well, there's an interesting little progression here, beginning with Genesis 26:19. Isaac's servants dug in the valley and discovered a well of fresh water there. But the herdsmen of Gera, the Philistines, quarreled with Isaac's herdsmen and said, "The water is ours." They dug a well, and the Philistines came and said, "The water is ours." And so Isaac named the well Esek. Now, Esek means dispute or argument. There was a quarrel there. And so they named the well Esek. And then they dug another well. But they quarreled over that one also. And so he named that one Sitna. Now Sitna means anger or opposition. It means I'm tired of this foolishness, and if you do it again, I'm going to knock your block off. That's essentially what it means in a kind of a loose translation. And then he moved on from there, and he dug another well. But no one quarreled over that one. And he named it Rehoboth. And Rehoboth means settlement. Actually, what it literally means is room enough for everyone. Settlement. And so Isaac named the well Rehoboth, saying, "Now the Lord has given us room, and we will flourish in the land." Now his servants went on a little bit further north, and they dug one more well. And at that place, Isaac went up and he built an altar there. That was not his home. That was a place where he worshiped. He built an altar there and called on the name of the Lord, and he pitched his tents there, and he named that well Sheba, which means oath. And even today, that well is still there and is still flowing, and it's called Beersheba, which means well of the oath. Now, Isaac discovered what was important to Ruth. He discovered it was not the land. It was the relationship that was important. What we're looking for is not a place to settle. What we're looking for is a people that we can be at peace among. A people that we can be at peace among. And the only place that the man or woman who is searching for God can find peace is among the people of God. It'll never be found anyplace else. That's the reason that the church, in its pure sense, is family. Not an organization. It's family. And that's the reason that if we're really going to be biblical about it, we call each other brother and sister in the church, because we have entered into family, and that's home for us. We've got some folks in our church back in Florida that relationship is the most important relationship in all the world. And if they get transferred by the corporation they work with, we got some engineers that work with RCA, And they'll lose a government contract up at the Cape, and they'll say, we're going to transfer you and your whole division out to Seattle, Washington. And they say, oh, no. No. I don't leave here just for financial reasons. This is home. This church, these are my people. I'm not going to leave my people. We are going to stay. And we have had numbers of people who have moved to that place as transits and have put their roots down. And they have said, Rehoboth, we're home. This is where I live. This is where I will be buried. Because these are my people. Now, the thing that drew Ruth to Bethlehem was not Bethlehem. She had never been there. The thing that drew Ruth to Bethlehem was Naomi. A relationship had been established. And out of that relationship, a home had been formed. Now, I believe that's what God is saying to his people. That's the word I want to leave with you here tonight. That for every one of us, our hearts are homesick for the courts of God. We're homesick for the things of God. I'm homesick for God the Father. What I want more than anything else is the Father's arm around me. And the words I need to hear more than any other words in all the earth is, well done, my son. That's what I want to hear. I'm glad I heard it from an earthly dad. But far more than that, I need to hear it from my heavenly Father. And that's what my search is all about. That search is to come into his presence and to know that I have entered into home. Now, let me tell you a little story, and I'm going to quit. We just married off our youngest daughter about a month ago. It's been a shaking time for us because now our nest is empty. We've had five children, and four of those are married, and our oldest son, who has been away from home for several years, is getting married this fall, and that kind of rounds out the whole bit. And so Jackie and I have gone through the whole empty nest syndrome that middle-aged people go through. And we have been struggling with this as our daughter has gone off. And then she calls home from New Orleans, where her husband is in the Coast Guard, and says, Daddy, I want to come home. And for me to say, honey, home is where your husband is. It's not here any longer. That's part of what we did in that wedding ceremony. We tied a knot and we cut a string. That's what happens in a wedding ceremony. Now, the time will come, as it has with our older children, when they'll migrate back, perhaps, build a house there and become part of the clan. And I become the patriarch with my tent in the middle of all of the flocks and herds. And I'll sit around the fire and drink tea and pass on the oral tradition of the family. But that's not there yet. That's just kind of one of my hopes as I grow older, that my kids will move home and take care of me. But we married Sandy off, and she's been a joy and a delight for us. We had an experience about 5 years ago which kind of cemented us together, I guess, more than anything that's happened. We had our next to youngest son, who is 3 years older than Sandy, unmarried at the time. The two of them were there together. All the older kids had gone off. And so Tim, who was a prankster of the first degree, and my scaredy cat daughter, Sandy, were there at the house. And Jackie and I had gone off to eat one night. We'd gone out with some friends and had left them at the house alone in the evening, and told them where we were going to be. I said, if there's any problems, why call us? We'll be home about 10 o'clock. They're both teenagers. We figured they could handle it. Well, about 9 o'clock that night, we got this frantic phone call from our daughter, Sandy, screaming over the phone, come home, quick, quick, right now, quick. What's wrong? Well, she couldn't tell us. It was just imperative that we get there. So we quickly excused ourselves and got in our car and drove the 8 or 9 miles back to our home. We live in the country. It's very dark out there, and there's no street lights. We live on a dirt road and surrounded by 20 acres of pasture and pine trees. And when we pulled up into our driveway, we got a long driveway that goes back into our property, pulled up into our driveway, every light in my house was on, all the outside spotlights, everything. I mean, the whole place looked like a Christmas tree. And I thought, well, they've had some kind of huge party out here of some kind. But there wasn't any activity around the house, just all the lights were on. And we pulled up in the driveway and rushed to the door and pounded on the door. And Sandy peeked around the corner and saw it was us and came rushing to the door. Opened it up and let us in. And it wasn't until after we got in the house that we found out what had taken place, what had gone on. She had been inside watching television in the den. Now, we have a long balcony that extends the whole width of our house, which is a second-story balcony that runs around the back part of the house. And the windows of the den open out underneath that balcony. And our son, Tim, realizing that his younger sister was in the den watching television, had gone up on the balcony and had gotten a white bed sheet and was moving slowly, this is night now, moving slowly back and forth across this window, swinging that bed sheet in a kind of a shadowy way. Sandy was sitting there in the den watching television and saw this apparition move past the window, and then pretty soon it moved past the window in the other direction, and she had gotten extremely panicky and had rushed to turn on the lights to find out what it was, and when she got to the back door, she saw written in the dust on the door pane, "I'm going to get you." Well, that was when she made the phone call. When we got there, she was sitting on the sofa with this butcher knife in her lap, just petrified over the whole situation that had taken place. Well, I decided that I needed to speak to Tim found out that even a big, hefty teenage boy needs a certain amount of physical discipline every now and then, and I explained to him that he had probably taken a number of years off of his sister's life, and therefore I was going to take a few ounces of blood out of his system at the same time, and that he said, "That's all right. It was worth whatever I did to him. It was worth it." You know, it's awfully hard to spank a kid when you're laughing, you know. but anyway, we went through our physical discipline, and then I went upstairs to Sandy's bedroom, and she was back in her bedroom. Jackie had already been in and done her best to calm her. And she was lying there, as she so often did when she got scared like that, with the cover pulled up. She's lying on her back with the cover pulled up right up against her chin, just the top part of her face sticking out from underneath the cover. No hands, nothing, just that top of her head sticking out. And I sat down on the side of the bed, and I talked with her for a few minutes and prayed with her. And I said, "Now, honey, it was just Tim. It wasn't a ghost. And there wasn't anything out there that was going to get you. It was just your big brother, and I've already got him. And I want you to know that has been taken care of, and everything is okay now." And then I prayed with her. And I got up and I said, "Now, sweetheart, it's late. We've been at this thing. We have been at it for a couple of hours, going through all of that mess that we've gotten." And I said, "It's after 11 o'clock, and you've got to go to school in the morning, and it's time to go to bed." So I got up and started to leave the room, and I reached up for the light switch. And she said, Daddy, don't turn the light off." I said, "Honey, yeah, I turn the light off. You're going to have to go to sleep. I'm going to leave the light on in the room. Daddy, please don't turn the light off. Honey, someplace along the line, you're gonna have to realize that you can't keep the light on all night long every time there's some kind of booger outside. And one of these days, you're going to get married and move off someplace, and you can't keep the light on all night long. Daddy, please, just tonight,
don't turn the light off. Please leave the light on. And I reached up to the light switch and cut it off. And then I moved back into the bedroom, pulled the covers down, and crawled up into the bed beside her. And she snuggled over and put her head against my chest. And we lay there for just a few minutes, arm in arm. She was asleep. And I realized something. She didn't need the light. She needed her daddy. That's all she needed. That's all I need. There's a lot of darkness in this world. And I'm not sure I'll ever understand a lot of the answers to the questions I keep asking. I'm an intelligent guy. I'd like to have light. But that's not what I need. What I really need is my Father. That's all. And it's Jesus who opened the door that we can walk in to the Father's throne room. He said, I'm the way, the truth, the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. But when we enter into the Father's presence through Jesus, then the desires of our heart are met. We're homesick for God. And through Jesus, we come home. Bow with me in prayer, would you please? We started tonight by saying that nobody's here by accident. God has a purpose in your life. And the first of those purposes is to reveal himself to you. That's his great desire, is to reveal himself to you. He wants you to know him and to walk with him and to have fellowship with him the same way that Adam and Eve had it in the garden before sin entered the picture. He wants to have fellowship with you. And he wants you to have fellowship with him. Our purpose in being here this weekend is to reveal to you Jesus Christ, that you may have fellowship with God. We're going to have a good time. We're going to do a lot of things. We're going to meet a lot of people. We're going to enjoy the time. But tonight, as you put your head on your pillow and everything gets quiet, before you drift off to sleep, would you spend just a few moments thinking about God the Father? How much he loves you. And how you have this yearning and longing on the inside for home. And how it can be met in a relationship with him. And so tonight, before you go to sleep, would you pause and allow him to reveal himself to you? He'll do it. Because he knows what your heart cries for. And so, Father, that's the way that we wrap it up tonight, believing that you've called us here together, that you're turning us into family, the family of God, that this place becomes our Rehoboth. And for these few days, we're going to settle, and you're going to speak to us.